Welcome to Bicom's podcast. I'm Bicom CEO James Serene. I'm delighted to be joined in Tel Aviv by Dalia Scheinlin, who is the presenter of the Tel Aviv Review podcast. So I'm a big fan of your podcast, Dalia. It's great to have you again on our podcast.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
We want to talk about your area of expertise, which is polling, and what is the Israeli public thinking as we go into these third elections. I know that a lot of our listeners will be maybe sighing, rousing themselves to get interested again in what are the dynamics of Israeli politics, why it is we've got three elections. And I suppose my first question is it crazy to keep asking the Israeli people the same question and expect a different answer?
It's not crazy if the Israeli public was in a different frame of mind than they were a number of months ago, like in September when we had the last elections, or in April. But the Israeli public hasn't really changed its mind about where different groups in society stand ideologically. They haven't changed their minds about how right-wing, centrist, or left-wing they are. Not since September, not since April, and not for over 10 years. We're not going to see a significant shift of people from the right to the left, or from the left to the right, or from the center to somewhere else. Having said that, it doesn't take an earthquake to at least get to a situation where there's a majority for one side or the other, or the middle sides, to be able to form a coalition. Right now, both of the ideological blocks, the right-wing parties, the center and left-wing parties, are both reaching somewhere between 55 and 57 seats. All they need is another 5, 6, 7 seats, which is roughly 5 or 6% of the vote, to tip the scale so that we can at least have a government. And I'm not even talking about whether it's a right-wing or a center or left-wing government for these purposes. So we're talking about a small percentage of people who either need to change their minds. I don't expect anything bigger than that, and I'm not even sure if that 4, 5, or 6% will change their minds. We could very well get the exact same result as we got in September, which was very similar to the results we got in April. If that were to happen, all of this really depends on the decision-making of a few political elites. And those are the two leaders of the biggest parties, the leader of the party that has been put in the position of kingmaker, which is Avigdor Lieberman, the head of Israel Biteinu. Israel is our home. The party that got 5 seats in April and 8 seats in September and ended up not joining a right-wing coalition, which brought us to the situation that we're in now. Not that I personally blame Lieberman as the main reason. In fact, the plurality of Israelis, over 40%, blame Netanyahu. But some combination of Netanyahu, Lieberman, and Benny Gantz, the head of what is functioning as the opposition party, somewhere between those three lies the responsibility for what will happen in the next set of coalition negotiations, assuming we don't see a major change in the election results. Having said that, as a political advisor and a public opinion researcher who has, you know, either worked on or very closely observed every Israeli election over the last 20 years, and researched at this point most of the elections before that too, we've learned to expect surprises. There are always unexpected things that happen in the course of a campaign in Israel, and oftentimes even in the ballot box. Some of this is stuff that can't really be, that was not picked up by polls beforehand. Sometimes the polls can predict it, but it's not a surprise if there is a surprise. And so I will never say never. It doesn't look at this point like anybody has a majority of 61 seats without Mr. Lieberman. But we have to always leave a little room for the possibility of the unexpected.
So let's break down some of those possibilities for change. I mean, as you said, to remind our listeners, 120 seats in the Israeli Knesset, 61 seats to get a majority. The reason why we're in this situation is that neither Bibi Netanyahu and Likud could build up with their allies to get to that 61, and Benny Gantz couldn't do that as well. And as you said, Lieberman was the kingmaker. But we've seen a little bit of change. So one change that interested me slightly after the last election was just, in a sense, relatively how badly Likud did. So if we remind listeners that Likud got 35 seats alongside Blue and White in April, they then joined up with this Kulanu party, led by Moshe Kahlon, joined Likud. And so for the September election, they should have got even a bigger bounce from actually merging with that party.
Right, they could have had 39 seats because Kahlon theoretically brought 4 more seats.
But it didn't happen. Likud lost votes in total. You could argue that Bibi's campaign was worse than in April, and they lost votes. So Do you think that the Likud campaign is getting worse and that he's losing more voters, Bibi Netanyahu?
Well, it's hard to know whether this is the fault of the campaign. Mm. I mean, we talk about campaign, we usually talk about the few weeks or the month or the month and a half or the 60-day or 90-day period before elections. I'm not sure if the campaign is the problem, and not only because I'm defending my colleagues who are campaign professionals who work on the right, but actually I think that this has a lot more to do with what Netanyahu has come to represent. For the left and the center, we know what he represents. The left and the center are clear. He represents the wrong direction for Israel. He represents an ideology they don't want. He represents a populist kind of right-wing government that they see as undermining democratic values and taking Israel towards the direction of annexation and all sorts of things they don't like. That's clear. The question is what he has come to represent for the right, more so than what he did in the 90 days before the campaign. And I think that while the right wing in polls certainly have very favorable attitudes towards him, and they give him a lot of credit for all the things that they see as going right in Israeli society, primarily a flourishing economy, greater global integration, new allies that Israel has been cultivating under Netanyahu, or that Netanyahu has been cultivating for Israel, and, you know, staving off some of the threats that Israelis thought they might face over in previous years. They give him all the credit for that. But there are some people, even on the right, who are starting to become skeptical on a number of levels that he should be the person to continue leading the country. One of the main reasons is that simply some people on the right, even if they like him, think that he's been prime minister for too long. Mm. And they say, you know, even though we like him, in a democracy, that's not really healthy. Some may be getting skeptical of the distraction of his legal cases. They may not truly believe he's guilty. They may even believe that he's being persecuted by political opposition. But they're starting to question whether it's really healthy for any country and a democracy to have a prime minister who is distracted by investigations and now indictment, which will eventually turn into prosecution. That is, if he doesn't get immunity, which looks increasingly unlikely. So those kinds of people may be on the right wing, but they are not really prepared to just give him a blank check and continue voting for him. Those are the people that we saw defect between April and September. Even leaving aside the potential of the four seats that Kulanu could have brought. And those people went to both the right and the center, or the other versions of the right. In other words, some of them went to the party called Yamina, which is a sort of an amalgam of a couple of right-wing religious nationalist parties. Some of them went to Avigdor Lieberman, who rose three seats between April and September. And maybe a few of them peeled off and went to blue and white, but very few as far as we can tell. Mm.
But the interesting thing about that, and you mentioned his indictments for corruption, is that before the April election, in February, the Attorney General said that he was minded to indict. He was recommending that Netanyahu be indicted for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust pending a hearing. And then he went into that April election and won 35 seats. And then in between the April election and the September election, we saw efforts by people around him, led by him, to try and maybe change the law so that he would get immunity and change the way the Supreme Court could review the way a Knesset granted immunity, all kinds of shenanigans going on behind the scenes to try and secure that, and that looked all a bit unseemly. That didn't, well, it had some impact, but not great impact in the September election. We talked about them losing votes. Now we've had the Attorney General recommend that he be definitely 100%, had the hearings, haven't seen any new evidence.
It's no longer a recommendation, it's a decision.
So it's a decision. And so, you know, there's efforts going on in the Knesset, as you say, to reject that request by him for immunity. So as we go into the March election, it's quite possible that the next stop for him is either a criminal trial or a plea bargain. Is that finally going to have an impact? Or have all his supporters priced it in and the people that have decided that they're going to leave him, have they already left him? Flux there?
I mean, even in the April elections, for the most part, none of this was new or surprising, right? Mm. Already in February of 2018, the Attorney General had named him as a suspect in some of the cases, and the people who were either for him or against him had factored that into account, you know, a year prior to the April elections, at least over a year.
And his strategy was very interesting. It was very overt. I mean, he went for a very sort of out front strategy. He talked about this incessantly. He had the narrative about, you know, the fact that it was a conspiracy against him. And so it wasn't like he was trying to hide from it. He was trying to persuade people.
I mean, this is the thing, is, you know, we could describe it in the terms of Netanyahu is portraying it and spinning it as a narrative in which he's being politically persecuted. But I think it would be a failure to understand why people actually support him to only characterize it as somebody's narrative. Mm. There are many people in the country, possibly a quarter of the voters, which is the percentage of the vote that Likud got, who truly experience this as political persecution. Now, do we really believe that Netanyahu believes it? Maybe. He was pretty convincing when he gave his response speech to the decision of the Attorney General to indict him in late November, I think. That chunk of the voters experiences what has been happening throughout the years of this investigation as a sort of feverish commitment on the part of alienated left-wingers who are afraid that they will lose power as the erstwhile elites of Israeli society, and that they are unable to win at the ballot box, and therefore they are trampling the will of the people through illegitimate means, manipulating the judiciary, taking over the judiciary, and masterminding the different branches of the judiciary, from the law enforcement agencies, the police, the state prosecutor, and the attorney general, to topple Netanyahu from power, basically in a coup. Mm-hmm. And that is how they experience it. We can call it a narrative, but at least many of the voters truly believe that. Mm.
And in terms of the polling, I mean, has the numbers of people that think he should just resign increased, or has it stayed the same over the last
year? It's been pretty stable because, again, over the last year, the people who wanted him out already wanted him out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the numbers have not really changed that much. You know, it depends on what's going on at the time. So we say, when we ask in polls, do you want him to resign if he's indicted? Do you want him to resign if there's an actual a prosecution going on? Do you want him to resign if he's convicted? I mean, you get different numbers for all of these. But the fact is, here's the bottom line. Netanyahu gets 25% of support in the ballot box. When you ask people about favorability or should he resign, you will always get about 40 to 42 or 3% who say, no, he shouldn't resign, or I support him, or I feel favorable towards him. He has a base of support for people who agree with his explanation for these legal cases, for people who generally feel favorable towards him, that's bigger than his vote share. But it's an important measure anyway. There's about 40 or slightly more percent of the country who is basically on his side. But that means that a majority are not.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we saw this in the polls.
So let's talk about his challenger, Benny Gantz. And he ended up leading the largest party at the second attempt. There's a fascinating story about Benny Gantz, which is that he only entered politics in early 2019, and everyone was saying, you know, we've not seen this guy, we don't know what he can do. And some people assumed that this would be his one and only chance for some time. And then he gets what no novice politician, very few novice politicians ever get the chance to do anywhere around the world, which is to then fight three elections in a row. So I guess the question is, is he getting better? And has the blue and white campaign got better? I mean, I've asked some of the people in blue and white this, and it's interesting, actually. They definitely feel more battle-hardened. Whether they're actually producing a more effective campaign is another question, but they're definitely more battle-hardened, they're more experienced. So I suppose you as a pollster, is Benny Gantz, having now had all this time as the challenger in the Israeli public eye, like, is he starting to look more like a prime minister, or is he just starting to look like another politician?
I mean, it's a good question. In some ways, we're living in an era when these outsiders come into politics out of nowhere, sweep the political stage, and somehow the voters view them as very prime ministerial. I mean, yeah, we had Emmanuel Macron in France, who seemed to come out of nowhere and become president of the country. We had Trump, who didn't exactly come out of nowhere, but he certainly was an outsider to the political system. And in many ways, you could argue that they won because they were outsiders to the political system. Mm-hmm. And in a strange way, you know, looking at it in that frame, you might argue that Benny Gantz did best in his first campaign, not because his campaign was more or less professional, but because he was newer and fresher and, you know, kind of breathed new life into the Israeli political system. When he gave his first speech after a long speculation period during which he didn't say very much, you know, commentators were starting to poke fun at him for not actually saying very much at all. He was poking fun at himself. Yeah. But he finally gave a campaign speech, and people, you know, in many ways were electrified by it because he finally spoke and said stuff, and he did a good job, and he brought energy despite the fact that he's somewhat old. And now, I'm not sure if you could say he's become more or less prime ministerial because he hasn't actually held any responsible positions. Mm. He's been busy fighting campaigns for the last year, not holding any government positions, not holding any ministerial positions, and essentially being a member of Knesset, but a Knesset has been, you know, only partly functional. And so it's hard to say he looks more prime ministerial. He may look as prime ministerial, but not much has been able to change that image. I think his campaign did okay. Obviously, they did okay because they got a similar number of seats in the second election in September, and they're polling in the number one spot right now. They're still the top-ranked party in all public opinion surveys. Very consistently, they're getting about 34 seats, which is not very different from what they got between the two different elections. So apparently, people see him as prime ministerial, but I have to say that I don't think the majority of blue and white voters are supporting blue and white because they absolutely are in love with Benny Gantz. He is not a cult of personality figure. That moment of charisma during that first speech has never really recurred in the same way. In fact, you could say the bookend to it was when he gave an interview from Washington at some point. I think it was still during the first campaign, when he was in Washington for, must have been the APAC conference, and he had a cold, and he looked deathly pale.
And it was
kind of a bookend to that first splashy speech that he gave. So I don't think he looks more prime ministerial. I think the people who are supporting blue and white, the main thing that unites them, as the right has accused them of, is basically being against Bibi continuing to be prime minister of Israel after 10 years in power, coming up on 11 years, actually. But the right accuses blue and white of being essentially an anti-Bibi party, and I think that there's truth to that as the unifying factor, but I think it's for different reasons than the accusations of the right wing hold. In other words, when the voters say we're anti-Bibi, they're not just saying it because they actually have a preternatural hatred for him. They don't like what he represents for the country. They don't like the direction that he's taking the country. They don't like his policy. They don't like his governing style. And they don't like his coalitions. And so they don't like what he's doing in terms of annexation, de facto annexation, and increasingly annexation through legislation and diplomacy. They don't like what he's doing in terms of religious parties and coalition and no real progress on separation of religion and state. Those are genuine reasons to want a change of leadership. And if it takes the form of saying, just not Bibi, that doesn't mean that it's only about personal hatred.
Yeah. I mean, there have been some commentary recently that the Blue and White Party is kind of tacking right. They've been trying to appeal more to the soft right-wing voters that might be dissatisfied with Bibi that we were talking about earlier. There was the moment where Benny Gantz appeared to now support applying Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley. And although he hedged it and said, you know, be subject to various things that might actually make it never happen, but there's certainly been a lot of discussion about it and about maybe it's their strategy now and they're actively trying to pick up these soft right-wing voters. I mean, do you think that is going to be perceived to be successful over time? I mean, do you think that that's actually going to scoop up some of these right-wing voters and give them more seats?
It's a very hard call. I mean, they are certainly trying to make an appeal to the kinds of voters who might defect blocks from the right to the center, and specifically defect from Likud. In fact, the voters who are self-defined as moderate right or soft right generally vote for either Likud or Lieberman. Maybe some of them vote for Shas, a very small number. But those are the kinds of voters who might leave. And blue and white is absolutely right to appeal to them. The question is, what is the way to appeal to them? And when I say they're absolutely right to appeal to them, there's no getting out of the situation unless some people change blocks. Without even taking a stance right now on which direction. If people don't move from the center and left block to the right, there will be no majority and no government easily. If people don't move from the right to the center and left, there will be no majority. So blue and white is correct to do this. The question is, what will make the difference? And traditionally, when parties that are viewed as left-leaning try to sound more right-wing with relation to the conflict, they don't do very well. Think about the person who was leading Labor during the April elections, Abi Gabay. When he first took the leadership of the Labor Party, he said, I'm going to try to change the brand of Labor so that it doesn't look quite so left-wing anymore and appeals to more mainstream Israelis. And he made a few statements that sounded like they were tacking to the right, and he ended up looking ridiculous, and Labor had its worst showing ever in those elections. And now Benny Gantz might not be in quite the same position, because blue and white really has done a very convincing job, quite organically, of being similar to Likud on those policies. And the idea that he had a major change of heart or a turnaround on some level when he announced that he would support Israeli sovereignty over the Jordan Valley is somewhat misleading, because in their party platform, they state quite clearly several fairly right-wing positions, that there would never be another disengagement involving dismantling of settlements, that they would strengthen the major settlement blocks, and that they would always retain the Jordan Valley as a security border. Now, what does that mean? It was hard to know, but it seemed clear that they were proposing that Israel remain permanently in the Jordan Valley. So this is just another version of that. It's not any sort of watershed shift of their policies. And I think that, on the other hand, Gantz getting dragged into an outbidding over annexation, a kind of annexation fever, a competition with Bibi, can never really work to his favor. You will never be able to do Bibi as well as Bibi on security and conflict-related issues. And so I'm not sure why he thinks that is the issue that will take the moderate right wing away from Likud. If you're playing on that turf, the right wing of any sort will probably prefer the original version. Mm. It's always seemed to me that blue and white should stake out other positions that may be tough for the moderate right in terms of their support for Likud. The fact, for example, that Likud has presided over 10 years in which there has been no real advancement on either drafting the ultra-Orthodox, this is what Lieberman made as his central platform, or in generally separating religion and state, or the increasing discomfort of many people, even on the right, with Netanyahu's broadside attacks on the judiciary and the arms of law enforcement in Israel. Those are the kinds of things that even hardline right-wingers who are security-oriented or nationalist on the Jewish identity issues, it makes many of them uncomfortable. Mm. And nobody's really taking an opposition position on that.
But they were talking, it's interesting you say that, because they were talking a lot about that before, was it I forget the elections, but
they
I think it was before
together.
The April election, where Benny Gantz's strapline was much more about building a separate secular coalition. We had between April and September and beyond all this talk from Avigdor Lieberman about not going into coalition with the ultra-Orthodox. It seemed to be a very strong theme, and it seemed to be that the Israeli public were hearing a lot about one group of politicians who were saying the ultra-Orthodox, their time was up.
Certainly on religion and state.
Yeah.
But I think at that time, in a way, blue and white was already behind because they were competing with Lieberman.
Right.
I
mean, but my question is that going to continue for the rest of this campaign? Will we hear more of that religious secular stuff?
I don't know what blue and white are concocting in the minds of their campaign strategists or in their headquarters. And we haven't seen much of it yet. In fact, we're not quite at the campaign stage where we're seeing all of the slogans and the posters and the ads. They're just starting. And I think that many of them are still struggling to finish their public opinion research, analyze it, come up with their strategies, and then do the copywriting that brings us these nice slogans. What we can see are the political developments. And so far, in the absence of some sort of a tagline or a slogan or even graphics for blue and white that would indicate what they're going to focus on, what we see is Benny Gantz involved in, a kind of outbidding competition with Netanyahu on issues where Netanyahu will always appear stronger among right-wingers. And so that's their campaign right now, simply because we haven't seen any other manifestation of their campaign.
Yeah. It's definitely, the campaigns are getting shorter, which is, they're almost becoming British, and they're sort of, these were just like intensive campaigns
when you say shorter,
rather than 3 months.
Well, when you say shorter, what you mean is they're getting shorter in terms of by choice. In other words, in terms of how
the parties actually
decide to put their major energy and money into big advertising and promotion. By law, the campaign periods haven't changed. There's still 90 days.
So let's do a quick sort of going around the houses on some of the smaller parties. I mean, it seems like that there isn't going to be much change on the sort of outer section. So the ultra-Orthodox parties, got all that support, very high turnout, not really going to change.
Very sectoral support.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be a little bit of change with Shas, because Shas has a base that is both ultra-Orthodox, who are a bit of a captive audience, but then they also have a traditionalist base, who are, when I say traditionalist, I mean religiously traditional, who are not as kind of conformist about how they make their voting choice. And they might go back and forth a little bit between Shas or Likud. So we may see small change there. But all of the polls, again, are in a way remarkably stable for those small parties. They're all polling within one seat of their current Knesset strength.
So like the same with Yamina, with the Naftali Bennett group. That looks like it's going to get the same as it did last time.
Very little change.
We've got the new merger between Meretz and Labour, which was before Meretz was Democratic Union. So that's polling
slightly lower, actually, right now. About 9 seats right now. At present, the two of them together have 10 seats or 11, I can't remember offhand, but you know, they're holding at a very similar level to what they had.
So that brings me to our final group, which is the third largest party in Israel after the last election, which was one group of parties, the Joint Arab List of parties, that actually very significantly increased their number of seats, mainly because they had a very historic low in the April election, so there was a reaction to that, and they got up to 13 seats in the September election. Is there growth there? I mean, they've talked about maybe getting up to 15. Can you see there's more growth?
I can see that, because there's only two populations in Israel that really hold the potential for some sort of change in the electoral map. One, we already talked about. That's the soft right. If they change their minds in significant numbers, they are a big portion of the population. The right wing in general is about half of Israeli society. Roughly half of those, 20-25% of total society, are moderate right. If they change their minds, even in small percentages, that could really shift the map. The other population that really has the power to change the electoral dynamics is the Arab population, and the reason is because they vote at a much lower turnout rate to the Jewish population. By the most sensitive measures of their turnout, and these are slightly estimates at some level, because we can only break them down by ballot station. And we don't know about every single ballot station what the population breakdown is. But for the most part, we can tell because there are cities and towns that are all Arab, and that's where high portions of the population live. And we know that they voted at a rate of about 60% last time in September. In April, they voted at only 49%, roughly. The Jewish population votes at over 70%, 75%. If you factor in all the people who are abroad, because Israel does not have absentee voting, Jews may have voted at close to 80%. Mm. And so the big gap there is room for growth. If the Arab turnout changes, that shifts the entire electoral map. That's the main reason why Joint List rose three seats. Okay, we're talking about close to 100,000 votes, between 90 and 100,000 votes. That's all primarily Arabs who turned out in September to vote, who did not vote in April, and a smattering of votes from the Jewish community. It's hard to assess exactly how many. Some people have talked about one seat's worth, which would be roughly 30,000 votes. I think it's probably less. But there is a sense of opportunity for them, partly because their strong showing in September created a fact in the Israeli consciousness that they are a party with real political clout. They are the third biggest party in Israel. If there had been a national unity government, they would have been the head of the opposition. That's unprecedented in Israeli life. They were suddenly a real potential player in the coalition negotiations when there was a possibility of them either joining a coalition, which was far-fetched, or supporting a minority coalition from the outside, which was a little more realistic, still kind of a long shot. But the fact that they made a statement recommending Benny Gantz as the Joint List, one of the parties within the Joint List later decided not to, but Benny Gantz also invited them for negotiations on some level. This created a new fact in the minds of every Israeli, that they are a political player. Whether people like it or not is a different story. Mm. But I think that knowing that is providing at least a certain amount of conversation, new kind of conversation, within all of the people in Israel who want to see a change of government about the possibility that their party could help bring it if they get more votes. And so of course, a higher percentage for them means a leveling off of the percentages and for all the other parties.
Yeah, so potential growth there that could be very significant. Mm-hmm. So my final question really, which you might not have a clear answer to, but if there's going to be any surprise, what do you think it might be in the next month?
Well, by definition, I can't know if it's a surprise. There's a few things we can look at from other elections in recent Israeli history. And when I say recent, I mean over the last 20 years. There's often a party that gets a surprise six or seven seats. Mm. In 1999, the first campaign I ever worked on, Shas got seven seats more than they were polling. Yeah. In 2003, Shinui got seven seats more than they were polling. This was a precursor to the Yesh Atid party, which was run by the father of Yair Lapid, who is the head of Yesh Atid party, which is part of Blue and White now. In 2006, there was a party run by a bunch of old men, tough old men, called the Pensioners Party, and they all of a sudden, running for the first time as a bunch of retirees, got a bunch of young people's protest votes and got six or seven seats. So that can happen, and it's usually people who, up to the last minute, are telling pollsters that they are undecided but plan on voting, but they make their decision at a very late stage, and the reason why they're having a hard time deciding is because they are kind of fed up with the parties that are on offering. actually, though, it's hard to know if that will pan out this time. It didn't really happen in the September elections. We didn't see that block of six seats or so going to one of the parties that was unexpected.
Is that because there isn't any party that is really close to not getting the required 3.25%, which gives them any seats? So we had this situation before when you had lots of small parties who were polling either to get sort of five seats, four seats, or not to get any seats at all because they're either side of this line. And what's happened is when Naftali Bennett's party, the New Right, you know, shock, failed to get that 3.25. They were incredibly close. They failed and he didn't get any seats at all. That kind of kicked off a wave of mergers, and every single party that basically was really in that small number of seats has now merged or formed a union. So it doesn't look like there is anybody that's going to disappear.
Maybe, but I think that you're conflating two things, which are both important things, but I'm not sure if one is really connected to the other.
Right.
In other words, it wasn't always those tiny parties that suddenly got the six seats. Sometimes it was old established. I mean, Shas was not a new party, nor was it in danger of going under the threshold in 1999, when the threshold was much lower, and it was already an established party. They just got the protest vote that time.
Right.
Same with Shinui in 2003. There is the danger of parties going under the threshold. You're right that in April, when Naftali Bennett and Yael Shaked's party went under the threshold, many right-wing voters said, we will not make that mistake again. But you're factoring in another thing that I'm not sure if it's totally related, which is the fact that parties often merge in Israeli elections, ahead of Israeli elections. It happened in 2013 when Likud and Israel Biteinu, Avigdor Lieberman's party, merged to create, I forget what they called it, Likud Biteinu, right. Mm. Likud is our home. I mean, It's a known thing going way back, decades back. Many of the parties in Israel, Likud itself, was originally an amalgam of several other parties. And that's a very traditional part of the Israeli system. In recent years, what we're seeing is parties merging, but also parties breaking up, parties emerging, establishing themselves ahead of elections, even though they never existed before, and sometimes collapsing entirely.
But we've got less parties now.
We have fewer parties running this time. We have somewhat fewer parties who actually got into Knesset. But we're not talking about a huge difference. I think the highest number of parties that's ever gotten into Knesset is around 12. I can't remember if it's 12 or 13. But now we have, you know, 8 or 9 roughly in the last couple of years. So it's gone down somewhat. It's not a bad thing. But then again, even with fewer parties, we are in the most paralyzed situation the country has ever been in. So, you know, it's hard to look at one of these trends and say, oh, this is taking us in a clearer direction. Not necessarily. We do have fewer parties in Knesset. That's supposed to be a good thing. And yet we've had no government for a year. We're going to our third election cycle and there's total paralysis. So I think really the point is that the country is being held hostage at this point to the decision-making of a few political elites. The people have said what they want to say. They said it in April. They said it again in almost the exact same way in September. They'll probably say something pretty similar this time. It's very hard to predict that surprise you're talking about. I think if we see a surprise, it's going to be a smaller percentage, maybe not 6 or 7 seats, maybe 4 or 5 seats changing. It's hard to know whether that change will be a shift of blocks or a shift within the ideological blocks. And yet again, we'll be dependent on the decisions of 3 or 4 political elites.
Sorry, I was a bit distracted there. The head of the Mossad just left the restaurant that we are sitting in, and I was tempted to ask him if he had any thoughts about the surprises before the next election. Dalia, thank you so much for joining us. We've covered so much ground, and I really don't want to say this, but you know, we may well be talking again ahead of the fourth election that will take place.
On that note, let me just tell you that on the night of the elections, in September, when the results came in, my colleagues and I looked at each other and said, oh, we might be heading into a third election because there's no clear winner. Mm. But this time, we didn't wait for the election results. We started talking about a fourth election the day they called the third elections.
Yeah,
we said there's going to be a fourth election.
It could well happen, but I'd like to thank our listeners for staying patient with us throughout all the podcasts we've done since the beginning of 2019 about the Israeli elections. We may well see some change in the weeks ahead, but do keep listening for all the best analysis about what's happening in Israeli politics. But thank you again, Dalia.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.